Welcome, dear students, to Chapter 11, Diversification and Risky Asset Allocation. And here is where we attempt to tie everything together, to go back to the beginning of the semester and look back at how we started with the eternal struggle of risk versus return. And in this chapter, we try to tie everything together in such a way that it all makes sense. Why did we do what we did? Okay, because of today, because of what we're going to take a look at today. And I had this one in my undergraduate degree years of mathematics professor for whom the entire class was completely lost. And on one lecture, he said, now we're going to try to tie everything together and hopefully it'll all make sense. And we were completely lost after the presentation. So I sure hope it doesn't turn out like that one. Let's get started. Slide number 2, diversification. Peter Lynch likes to joke and call it diversification. Diversification is spreading your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, of the risks of investing. There's an old saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. It makes sense, right? Yeah, exactly. Hedge your bets, you might hear people say, and we'll come and talk about hedging later on, but not in this presentation when we get to options and futures. But there's an old saying, not as old as don't put all your eggs in one basket, that is, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. Now, it's attributed to Mark Twain, but you have to be careful whenever you read any quote that is attributed to Mark Twain. Not that he didn't say some phenomenal things, folks. He did. Don't get me wrong. I mean, one of my favorite sayings from Mark Twain is, we have the best Congress money can buy. Right, not much has changed in over 100 years. But does it really make sense to put all your eggs in one basket and watch that I don't know. I mean, yeah, watch the basket fall and all the eggs crack. I don't know. Slide number 3. On a small screen, this might not be too easy to see, but what is this graph trying to show you? It's trying to show you on slide number 3 that diversification has been one of the best methods to reduce risk, because you don't know what asset class is going to be the best asset class. And these are the major asset classes in financial from 1987 to 2011. Large company stocks, the S&P 500. Global small company stocks. You would have thought they would have done very well compared to the others, and it turns out that okay, don't get me wrong, but not pretty lousy from sometimes when they really fall badly. International stocks. And then emerging, look, there's where the real returns have been, but also the real volatility. Oh, my goodness. That's why sometimes emerging market stocks are often sometimes called submerging market stocks. And now the favorite phrase is developing markets. Yeah, exactly. And they have, over the last 3 decades, have done very, very well, but have been tremendously volatile. Look at 2008, minus 53%, and then up 80%. bonds, U.S. bonds, have actually done very well since the 1980s, and international bonds. The last category is cash, and what I hope you take away from this graphic here, is not once did cash come out as the most profitable investment classification. And where do people want to rush when things go bad? Right, they're always wanting to rush into cash. Also, treasuries, too. Treasuries are another famous flight to quality security. But people are always saying, are you in the market now? No, I'm sitting in cash. And yet cash has never been the best asset class in any one of these years from 1987 to 2011. So we diversify our investments to reduce risk. And one of the cool things about diversification is that hopefully, you know, not all of our investments will be in the porcelain oasis, except for 2008. But it also guarantees that there's something in our portfolio that makes us sad, right? That's the way it works. That's diversification. By the way, let's take a look at 2008, and we see that stocks were clobbered, right? Let's get the cursor in here. See that stocks across the board were clobbered, and it looks like bonds did really well, right? Well, this is not, it's masking. Treasury bonds did very, very well. Exactly. And sovereign bonds of developed markets because of the flight to quality. But it turns out that a lot of bonds got clobbered in the 2008-2009 debacle, as we saw with the Ford bonds, if you took a look at that presentation. And so that 2008 5.24% for U.S. bonds is masking that some bonds were destroyed. So we diversify to reduce risk. But how do we measure risk? Slide number 4. Well, we've come full circle, folks. Way back in Chapter 1, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return. Risk and return. There's no way to get around that. We saw how the higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation and its companion measure variance from the average annual return. That's the way, that's one of the major ways, the major way actually that we measure risk. But is it perfect? No, it's not a perfect measurement. It just shows us that yes, it's going to be volatile. But does it tell us what's going to happen? No, it doesn't tell us who's going to be the next big thing, who is going to be the next worst thing. So we learned how to measure, or at least we don't measure it, we just look it up. In the book they teach you how to compute it, but we'll leave that for your statistics class. We saw how the higher the average annual return, the more volatile the asset class is going to be. And we studied the major financial asset classes, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, cash. We discussed the risks and returns of each asset class, and we found that return is pretty easy to measure. How much money did you make? How long did it take you to make it? How much did you start with? What did you end with? But risk is very difficult to measure, and it's even harder to anticipate. Exactly. 2008, very few people were really ready for that bolt of lightning from the sky. I got to tell you, I thought we were going down like 20%. I thought that this is, you know, we're going to get hit by this housing crisis. But I was no. I didn't think it was going to be as bad as it was. I have a friend who was very, very much believing in the belief camp that that was going to be a horrible time. And he was telling me, hey, real estate's going to fall 50, 60%. And I kept saying, I don't know, Jim. You know, that's a big drop for real estate. And if that happens, that means we're in, you know, but you have to go back to the Great Depression. And sure enough, he was absolutely right. But he was way too early. He thought it was going to happen 2006. Yeah, so yeah, exactly. You know it's going to happen. You know it's going to go down. You know it's going to go up. You don't know when, you don't know how much. Slide number 5. Variance and standard deviation. Variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. These measures are readily available from the investment community, and their numbers ain't pretty, folks. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is 49.5%. Well, 49.24%. That means in any one year, many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, the most stable stocks, right? Well, traditionally, but now, you know, some of them on the NASDAQ are a whole lot bigger. But the many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange will vary up or down close to 50% from their average annual return. Yikes! So how can we reduce the variance? In other words, how do we reduce the risk? How do we reduce the standard deviation? The answer, of course, on slide number 6 is to diversify. Because if we go from one randomly selected stock to two randomly selected stocks, the standard deviation goes down from 49% to 37%. That's a big drop. And if we go to 10 randomly selected stocks, it goes down to about 24%. 20 stocks, 21.5%, and so on. Diversifying our stock portfolio reduces our risk substantially, as measured by reduced variance and standard deviation, which we've already acknowledged are imperfect measures. Slide number 7. This graphic is showing you what happens as you add stocks into your portfolio. And again, these are random stocks that are thrown into the portfolio. As you throw more stocks into your portfolio, and from 1 to 2 to 4 to 6 all the way up to 1,000, you see the average annual deviation, the average standard deviation of the annual portfolio returns falling. And at first, it falls fairly quickly, right? But then what happens is we start to see the percentage decline level off. And you math fans will know this as a limit, right? It looks like a limit. It starts high and then falls quickly, but then smooths out. And then here's a ratio. You go from 100% down to 39%. Or the 19 or so is about 39% of the original 49%. What's going on here, huh? What's going on here? Slide number 8. There is a limit. And that's the term that the mathematicians use, in case you forget your math, to which diversification can reduce your risk in any given asset class. In this case, stocks. So we see, as we add stocks in the portfolio, we see the standard deviation falling rapidly until we start to add more and more stocks, and it doesn't really help us reduce our standard deviation anymore. Yeah, we're adding more and more stocks, and it's going down barely imperceptibly. And the book goes into diversifiable risk and non-diversifiable. We're not going to talk about that. But why is it? Why? Why is it true that there's a limit in any given asset class? In this case, we're talking about stocks, but it works for any asset class. Why? Because of correlation. Correlation. Slide number 9. Correlation is the tendency of the returns of two assets to move together. You understand? These assets are similar in that they go up and down about the same time, but no two assets are perfectly correlated. So we are counting on imperfect correlation. Imperfect correlation is the key reason why diversification reduces portfolio risk, as measured by the portfolio standard deviation, which we've already decided is not a perfect measurement to begin with. But we know that no two investment returns will be exactly the same. They might be correlated to one another. They might be positively correlated, meaning that they tend to move up and down together, but they're not going to be perfectly correlated. Well, there's an example on the next slide that are perfectly correlated. And, of course, negatively correlated assets mean they tend to move in opposite directions. So here comes the scary graph, which I'm sorry, not there yet. Slide number 10. The correlation coefficient, you often see it as R, lowercase r, uppercase R, is the measure of how closely returns on assets move together. Again, you don't have to calculate this. You just look it up. The correlation coefficient ranges from -1, -100%, meaning that the two assets move in exactly the opposite direction. One goes up, the other one goes down. If it's 0, 0%, it means they're totally uncorrelated. They just move in random to one another. And then +1 or +100%, they're perfectly positively correlated. So here are the graphs that I was referring to on slide number 11. You see the first two asset classes, asset class, these are two investments, and these are probably in the same asset class. Maybe they're both stocks. And so we see that the first one, A, moves up quite a bit. The second one, B, moves down, up, but it still moves up. Not quite as high, but they still move up. And then they move down together, and they move up together, and they move down together. That is called perfect positive correlation. And of course, as we said, no two investments are going to be perfectly correlated, but in this case they are. And they're showing it as an extreme example. Now, the second example are perfectly negatively correlated investments. When one moves up, the other one moves down. When the other one moves up, the other one moves down. And so they are negatively correlated. So maybe this one's a stock and this one's a bond. That's the punchline, folks. Wait till we get to the punchline. I'll tell you in a minute. And then this graph, which is actually not as good as the other two, but it's the same. It's trying to show you that these two assets, A and B, move unrelated to one another. But unfortunately, it kind of looks like they're related, doesn't it? They go doot, 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 doot. So the first couple of zigs and zags look very correlated, and then they become uncorrelated, right? Sort of negatively correlated here and then positively correlated. The idea, if it's a 0% correlation coefficient, or just 0.0, whatever, then the two asset classes move randomly against one another. One goes up, the other one goes down, and then the other one goes up, the other one goes up, and then the other both one goes flat, the other one goes up. They just don't do anything in sync with one another or out of sync as negative correlation. Slide number 12. So how does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risks of owning stocks? Keep adding more stocks and it doesn't reduce the risk to zero. Well, because all those stocks are not perfectly correlated, they are positively correlated enough so that stocks in general tend to move in the same direction. And you already knew this, right? That's why we refer to the stock investments as a whole as the stock market. How's the market doing? Well, it's going up, but not all stocks are going up. Or it's going down. Well, not all stocks are going down. And even though at any given time, some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and many are simply chugging along as they always have done. That's why adding 1,000 stocks to your portfolio doesn't really help you anymore if you just have 50 or 100. Correlation. Slide number 13. Darn! Darn! That is still too much risk for me. I think I's gonna stick to bonds. Well, you are a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and you don't particularly like the volatility of stocks, do you? Therefore, you decide to place all your investments into bonds. You will accept the lower return from the bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops. Bad idea. What? What are you talking about? Well, because like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. You understand? Interest rates go down, bonds go up. Interest rates go up, bonds go down. Exactly. They also will tend to do well and do poorly as a whole. And here's the punchline, folks, that I referred to. They are often, but not always, negatively correlated with stocks. Stocks and bonds often, but not always, move in opposite directions. They are negatively correlated. That is why it's a good idea to have stocks and bonds, especially if you just want bonds. It's a good idea to throw stocks into the mix. If you just love stocks and you're just dying for that volatility, then poof, you don't even care. But if you want bonds to reduce volatility, well, then it makes sense to add some stocks. What? Let's take a look at this slide. Slide number 14. Now, let me see if it makes sense here, folks. We're going to take a look at it in table form after this, but let's see if this makes sense. If you have a 100% stock portfolio, you're going to have the highest standard deviation, the most volatility, and you're going to, you know, all things considered, you know, all things equal and never are, have the highest expected rate of return. As you add bonds, we should see the volatility reduced, and that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing the standard deviation go down. But we're also seeing the expected return go down. Well, that makes sense. Bonds don't return as much as stocks. But what happens when we start to get to the point where we have more bonds than stocks and we add more and more bonds, reduce our stock exposure, our volatility starts to go up and our return goes down? What a bad deal that is. You know, we're reducing our rate of return as measured by this axis. It keeps going down and we're increasing our volatility. Yikes. And this table is simply that graph that we just saw on slide 14 in table form. We see, and they don't use percentages, they use 1.0 and 90.95, but you could just throw away the period and put percentages there. And you see, as you reduce your stock exposure from 100% down to zero, we see our expected rate of return falling. And we are increasing our bond portfolio, we're increasing our bond composition percentage. We see the standard deviation falling and the expected rate of return until we get to about, 30 or so percent stocks, 70% bonds. The standard deviation starts to go back up again because bonds are positively correlated with themselves. When they do badly, the volatility is greater because they all do badly. Slide number 16. Correlation and diversification. A combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk while earning you more than just bonds. Do you remember the balance funds and how we said for people who are worried about being able to sleep at night, this is not a bad choice for them. You know, it's a way for them to invest in the stock market while still holding on the bonds and reducing their risk while still having a normally, all, you know, depends on what every mutual fund's different, but it's a great way to reduce risk and juice your returns. If you are seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, it also pays to diversify among asset classes. But you knew this already, I think. The same kind of relationship occurs with domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, although less now than in the past. That's why in the 1970s and 80s, international mutual funds became very popular because people had plenty of U.S. Stocks and bonds, and they wanted to have a counterbalance because the international outside the United States would do well when the United States was not doing well and vice versa. But that's not as true as it used to be. The world is so interconnected now. And I think we've said this, diversification is still not a guarantee of positive results. No diversification scheme worked well in 2008 unless your idea of diversification was treasury bonds and money market accounts. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor, right? It's called, on slide number 17, asset allocation. And we saw some mutual funds that were called asset allocation funds. Right, exactly. Fancy term. Fancy term for how much should I have in stocks? How much should I have in bonds? how much do they have of each type, box, doc, font, type, how much of each bond type. Many, for many decades, many investors suggested a formula such as subtract your age from 100, or 110, or 120. Why is it going up? Hang on a minute, relax. That is the percentage of stocks you should own. The rest should be in bonds. So let's say a 40-year-old person, they should have 100 minus 40, or 60% invested in stocks and 40% invested in bonds. And as you get older, you reduce your percentage of stocks and increase your percentage of bonds. So it used to be, whatever your age is, that's how much bonds you have. So 60 years old, you'd have 60% bonds, 100 minus 40, right? 100 minus 60, or 40% in stocks. But that's when people didn't live as long, right? And so you see the number going up to 110 or 120. And they're trying. What they're trying to do is they're trying to take into account the fact that people are living longer. But there are others, and I'm on this side of the fence, who say, poppycock! Right? I like that. Poppycock, don't do this. Buy high-quality stocks. Put up with the volatility. Now, not everybody can do that, folks. A lot of people don't want to do that. I think if they're educated and they're shown that if the whole thing falls apart, it doesn't matter where your money is, well, then hang it up. Put up with the risk, and once you're near retirement, start buying bonds, but don't give up on stocks entirely, because it used to be that people retired at 62 and died at 64, or didn't even make it to retirement, 65 or whatever. Now people are retiring at 62 and dying at 94, and going back to work at 64 because they're bored, or they're got an offer they can't refuse, or they just want to make some money, or whatever. So people are living far longer. So we say keep stocks in your portfolio for the long term. Inflation doesn't retire just because you do. Of course, in the 121 class, Financial Planning and Money Management, we have an entire section, actually sneak it in a few times, on about retirement and having the appropriate mix even in retirement, because of people are just living far longer. Slide number 18. Here's an example of asset allocation of $100,000. How do you divvy it up, folks? And I just pulled this right out of my hat. You probably see something like this in other people's examples of asset allocation. And I'm not suggesting this, especially for people who are younger. I don't think they should have any bonds. But that's me. That's me. Everybody's different. 25% bonds, 75% stocks. Okay, so that's 25,000 for bonds, 75,000 for stocks. In the bond portfolio, 15,000 put in high grade corporate and government bonds, 5,000 high yield non-investment grade junk bonds, some global bonds, 5,000. And in the $75,000 worth of stocks, put $25,000 in domestic growth and income, $25,000 global growth and income. I'm a big growth and income fan. Have you noticed that, folks? Yeah, 50% of the portfolio in growth and income stocks. And then here's your spice, aggressive growth, 10%, 10% international. And here's some real spice, the small company stocks, 5% of the total portfolio, $5,000. You like it? It's yours. You can have it. Or you might say, no, I want more bonds. I don't want that volatility. Or no, I want more stocks. What do I need? I'm 25 years old. What do I need bonds for? Good question. I'm with you. I don't think you need bonds. Slide number 19. Some of those same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest the technique of rebalancing. Each year, you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. So, for example, you had a 60-40 allocation, but stocks have had a great year. 2013 comes along. You might now be at 70%, 30% stocks, 70% stocks, 30% bonds, instead of your target 60% stocks, 40% bonds. So what do? You sell enough stocks and you buy enough bonds to bring the balance back to your target 60-40. And a lot of the mutual funds now have this service built into their websites. You just go on, you tell them what you want your your allocation to be, or maybe just tell them your age, and they'll do it for you. And then you say reallocate, and they do it for you. And I don't know. Likewise, if stocks have tanked, 2008 comes along, you sell your bonds and buy stocks to bring the percentage back to 60-40. Now, I'm not personally a big fan of this, but it's actually a pretty smart thing to do if you believe in having, you know, that balance. And don't do it every month, folks. Don't do it maybe every 6 months. Maybe once a year is good enough. The cool thing about this, the very good thing about this, is that it forces you to do the right thing. Stocks have done well. It's time to sell some. Right. Stocks have done poorly. It's time to buy some. It forces you to buy low, sell high, which is the exact opposite of how many investors act. Because who wants to sell stocks when they're going up? How, you know, that doesn't feel good. Hey, I want to keep buying more. And who wants to buy stocks when they're falling? Nobody wants to do that. Well, the smart people do. The time of maximum pessimism, Mr. Sir John Templeton told us, is the best time to buy. Slide number 20. Stocks and bonds in retirement. We spend our working years preparing for the retirement. What happens when we get in retirement? Well, many investors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. But as we've already said, this is not working as well as it did in the past. The only problem is people are living much, much longer. And here's a statistic that may scare you. I don't know. I thought it was pretty amazing when I read it. A 50-year-old living today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old. Now, that's a scary thought for some of us. And I loved it when my wife and my sister-in-law were visiting my mother-in-law in the nursing home, and they kept saying, "We don't want to live that long. We don't want to live that long." And I would say to them, "Well, you know, it's not so bad. I think you'll change. I think when you get there, you'll change your mind. You know, you won't be so... just put me out of my misery." No, I don't think so. As you near retirement, start migrating your investments from stocks and stocks to bonds, but don't abandon stocks entirely. Now, it's not there yet, but it will be. There'll be some illustrations of a stock-only portfolio, taking money out in retirement, a bond-only portfolio, taking money out in retirement, and then a balanced portfolio, taking money out in retirement. Okay, so that'll be there. It's not there yet, but it will be by the time you are viewing this or listening to this. So, slide 20. Let's take a look at slide 21. This is a comparison that is similar to the very first chart that we looked at. But this just shows us U.S. company stocks and U.S. bonds. So it takes a little bit of that previous graphic that we saw at the beginning of the presentation, and it just takes a look at S&P 500, U.S. large company stocks, and then it used to be called the Lehman Brothers Bond Index, now it's called Barclays Index, and it shows that for the most part stocks are going to do better. Right? You already knew that, but when stocks do really poorly, often bonds excel. Right? They do well. And oh boy, don't you see this? And you know, look at that. Look at 1990. Stocks went down, bonds went up, right? And then throughout the 1990s, stocks just went in two directions, up and way up. And then we see 3 years, 2000 to 2002, and yet bonds held up very well. Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work in the textbook. Doesn't always work in real life, but that's the idea. Stocks go up, bonds go down. Bonds go up, stocks go down. I'm sorry, did I say that right? Yes, all right. Bonds go up, stocks often go down. But not always. Having a balanced portfolio means that you almost never have the best returns in any one year. The only year you had better returns than stocks or bonds with a balanced portfolio was 1987. However, it also means that you will very rarely, if ever, have the worst returns in any year. So it means, sure, you're not going to have the best returns, but you also ain't going to be the worst. In addition, although it is very unlikely that your balanced portfolio will equal or surpass an all-stock portfolio, there are some exceptions of balanced funds having very good returns, even better than some stock funds over the long term. But it is unlikely that you're going to equal or surpass an all-stock portfolio. Just get that in your head before you do it, before you go with a balanced fund or go with a balanced portfolio if you pick your own stocks and bonds. You should do much better than an all-bond portfolio. But you already know what we're going to add to this, right? There ain't no guarantees, folks. Right, there are no guarantees. But you want to take a look at stock mutual funds. You want to take a look at bond mutual funds. And then take a look at what balanced funds have done. Some balanced funds have done very, very well. Slide 22, dollar cost averaging. We've already discussed this, haven't we? And hopefully you've seen it in other, certainly we discuss it quite a bit in the 121 class. This is a system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. It's kind of a boring definition, and it's kind of a boring system, $100 a month, $50 a month. But oh boy, it is cool, and practically the only way that most of us working grunts are ever going to invest. And the best part about dollar cost averaging, this is the best part, folks. Whenever you wake up in the morning, you know that there always will be good news. I tell my wife, I say Anita, because that's her name. Anita, no matter what happens tomorrow morning, we wake up, there's good news. Because either the market's up, good news, yippee, your account is worth more, your $100 is now $100.25. Or, the market's down, good news, what, huh, what are you talking about, Piano Pie? Wait, think about it. Next month, if the market goes down, you get more shares at a lower price when the $50 or $100 or whatever you can afford comes out of your paycheck or out of your checking account. This is a very powerful system for investing, because you don't have to decide when the best time to invest is. Every month is a good month to invest, assuming you have a long-term perspective. Exactly. Slide 23. Now, here's a dollar cost averaging example. Now, this one was taken from The Wealthy Barber, but there are dozens of these things out there on the web that you'll see. But I just used his numbers because these are really good numbers. Each year, you put in $1,000 or $10,000, whatever it is, into the investment. And at first, you found that the price was $10 a share. So you purchased 100 shares. So you have a cumulative total shares of 100. And then 2008 comes along, and it drops in 50%. And next year you put in $1,000 and you buy 200 shares. So now your cumulative total shares are 300. The third year, the investment bounces back, and you put in $1,000 and it's 750. So you get 133.333 shares, and your cumulative shares are 433 shares, 433.333. Now, it looks, when you just look at the share price, you know, $10, $5, $7.50, it looks like you broke even, right? Well, not quite. In this example, your average cost per share is $6.92. Why? Because you had $3,000 that you invested and you wound up with 433.333 shares. But the price per share currently is $7.50. So although it looks like you should have simply broken even, you actually made money. Why? Because you bought more shares at the lower price. You bought 200 shares when it was $5. 100 shares when it was $10, and 133.33 when it was $7.50. The value of your shares is $3,250. So it might look like magic or gimmickry, but it's not. It just makes sense. If you buy the same amount of shares, when shares go up, you're going to buy fewer, and when shares go down, you're going to buy more. So it's probably the closest thing to a brain damaged, I shouldn't use brain damaged, but just drop dead simple way of investing. You don't try to time when the best time to invest is. Sure, if you want to be a bit of a contrarian and the market falls precipitously, put a little bit more in. But most of us working grunts, we just don't have that money laying around. We're just having the money come out of our checking account, out of our paycheck. Slide 24. By always investing the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the prices are lower and fewer shares when the prices are higher. Your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. And I asked you to memorize this back in Chapter 4, and you probably didn't. And I'll ask you to memorize it now, and you probably won't. But I wish you would, because that is what makes dollar cost averaging so cool. However, as we always are saying, how come you're always saying that, Pana? Because it's true. It's not a guarantee of success. Dollar cost averaging is not going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. Ooh, look, I'm buying more shares. It keeps going down. Ooh, I'm buying more shares. It keeps going down. Ooh, you know what? It's zero now. What should I do? Yeah, no. Exactly. Do you understand? Yeah, you hope that it turns back. You mean it better turn back or you're going to have a total loss. But it does make investing very, very easy, folks. For mutual fund investors, that is. It's a bit trickier with stocks and bonds, but not impossible. Why? Because we don't buy $50 worth of a bond. It just doesn't happen. You have to, you know, get up at least $1,000, and then they don't want you to just buy one bond. It's easier, actually, with stocks than it is with bonds. That's why most of us working grunts are going to put most of our money into mutual funds. But, again, it's not impossible. I know several people who put $50 a month into their brokerage account, and then when they get about $500 or $600, maybe $1,000, they buy a stock, and then they build it back up again. Right, because you don't want to buy just one share at $50. You're going to pay $12 or $7 for the commission. You know this already. Good. Slide number 25: mutual funds and diversification. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds in the first place? Yes, it was. The other one is professional money management. But does that mean that mutual funds necessarily have less risk than individual portfolios or the market as a whole? Well, no. It all depends on which mutual funds we're talking about, folks. Some have higher standard deviation than the market as a whole. Some have lower. So, for example, go to Morningstar, finance.yahoo, or whichever one you like. Be careful with Morningstar. They're always going to try to sign you up for premium. Enter into mutual funds. Since I like this Dodge & Cox stock fund. You're going to find it's a really good fund, but it has higher volatility than the market as a whole. And then this other one is the Washington Mutual Investors Fund. And both of these funds have been around for decades, folks. It has lower volatility than the market as a whole. And then take a look at their returns, right? What did you expect, right? Find the link to risk. Or I think a Morningstar has ratings and risk. And then try some of your own mutual funds or mutual funds that you're thinking about investing in. And certainly this is the assignment for Chapter 11, to go out there and take a look at risk. Now, we've always concentrated on return. Now we're going to complete the analysis. We're going to take a look at the risk involved. Slide number 26. Mutual funds and concentration. What are you talking about, Piano? Well, this has always been a saying and a truism about the industry, but lately there's one company, I forget the name, Dunbar, or I forget the name of the company, but they have published some really great statistics showing how mutual fund investors really do have worse returns than the mutual funds they invest in. Why? Because they wait until the market goes way up before they put their money in, and then they wait until the market goes down before they take their money out. Exactly the opposite of what they should be doing. So what is this showing us? This is showing us inflows and outflows into stock mutual funds, equity funds, and bond mutual funds. And one of the times it's really a good time to look at is 1994. Look at what happened with bond mutual funds. People pulled out their money as interest rates started to rise in 94 out of their bond mutual funds. They did it again in 95. If you go back a few slides, you'll find that that was the worst time to take your money out of bonds. D. And then we see that stocks started doing really well throughout the late 90s. And sure enough, and in 1999, bonds went down a little bit. People took money out. And in 2000 was the height of the bubble. And look at the huge stock inflows, only to see the market turn. And we have three down years. And sure enough, in the middle of it, people, 2002, taking their money out of equity funds just in time for the stock market to turn around. And sure. And then 2008, whammo. Look at that. Every year for 4 years, at the worst possible time, they started pulling money like crazy out of their stock mutual funds at the time when you should be putting money like crazy into stock mutual funds. The market's gone down 50%. Time to buy. And then what happened to the bond flows? Right, they pulled their money out of stocks, started putting it into bonds. Why? Because I don't trust that darn stock market. You lose money there. And sure enough, bonds, they're going to always be. They're never. Well, it happened in 2003. Bonds went down. Now, if you go back a few slides, you'll see that it wasn't much, like 2%. But still. Right. We're wired to do this, folks. We're wired to make the exact wrong choice at the worst possible moment. So we have to be aware of this. We have to be on our guard. In my humble opinion, you have to be on your guard because your emotions are going to be, as Mr. Bogle has told us, as Mr. Graham has told us, as Mr. Buffett has told us, our worst enemy. We are going to be our own worst enemies, and we're going to be tempted to do the absolute worst thing at the worst possible time. Oh well, that's what you're up against. And that's why dollar cost averaging is so cool. I remember in 2008 when one of my friends I ride bikes with was saying, well, what are you doing? Aren't you taking all your money out of the stock market? I said, no, I'm not taking my money. In fact, I put a little bit more in, but for the most part, every month, money's coming out of my paycheck, every money's coming out of my checking account, into my 403B, which is our equivalent of the 401K, into the Roth IRA for my wife and I, for my wife and me. and then when the market's doing really, really well, same deal, you're putting money in every month. That's how I think most of us are going to invest. Enough said. Slide number 27. We're done! Not only chapter 11, but folks, we are done the entire semester. What? What are you talking about? Well, not really. Yes, obviously we have more to go through. But for the vast majority of us, we have gone through the major asset classes that we will be investing in. So you could stop right here, right? No. This is an introduction to investments class. So you need to understand options. You need to understand futures. You need to understand shorting, selling short, and margining. I'm not saying you should ever do any of these, and in fact, I'm going to spend the next few weeks trying to convince you not to, but you still need these. So we will now have our exam number 4, which will cover bonds and asset allocation, convertible securities, and a little bit of review, right, exactly, of stocks and the chapter 5, 6, constant perpetual growth model and the discounted cash flow model. And when we're done with that and you're ready to continue, we will take a look at stock options and I will do my best to convince you not to get anywhere near these things. Unless you're the kind of person who really does like Las Vegas and playing the lottery. In which case, you might actually find stock options fun. I think Mr. Confucius said it best 2,500 years ago. He who gambles picks his own pocket. See ya in our next presentation on stock options. And we don't use the word gambling in the financial world. We use the word speculating. Speculation. It's just another word for gambling.